You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, October 11th, 2008, and I am your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me today are, as always, Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah. And we have two special guests before we get to our this day in skepticism.
Calm down, Evan.
Joining us again, who was with us on our live show last year, is Steve Mirsky from Scientific American.
Hi, everybody.
And Terrence Hines.
Hi.
And this is our first annual Perry DeAngelis Memorial Live event. So thanks, everyone, for coming. And this event was made possible entirely by the generous donations of our listeners who donated to the Perry DeAngelis Memorial Fund so that we could do this sort of thing. And we definitely plan on making this an annual event.
Hence the name.
Hence the name. Lies. That's right.
And the grammarian in me has to say that, you know, first annual is... You should never say that. You know,
it's the first annual.
No. It's when the second one gets there, that's the second annual. But the first one's just the first.
But we are going to have one next year. So
just saying.
Hey, if the Ig Nobels can have the 10th first annual, we can have the first annual.
Here. Right.
I did want to start off just talking a little bit about Perry, of course. Perry DeAngelis, the sixth rogue, who's no longer with us, unfortunately. He passed away last August, actually just a week or so after our first live event last year. And Perry really is responsible for all of this in a very real way. I first met Perry, had nothing to do with skepticism. Actually, we were both attending a live-action role-playing event. A little bit different than this.
It's okay, you're allowed to laugh.
Thanks, Rebecca. So there was 100 people there, and you know it was every now and then sort of weekend event. And Perry and I became friends. He later told me that after we had a conversation, he realized I wasn't an idiot, unlike most of the other people there. So I was worthy of his friendship. He decided after we had a conversation. But our friendship really wasn't sealed until after he came to my house for the first time and noticed that there was an issue of the Skeptical Inquirer on my coffee table. That's a kind of a rare event. You're at somebody's home and you see the Skeptical Inquirer on their coffee table. Then he knew that he had found a friend. Immediately he focused in on that and said, I subscribed to that also. That was it. It was actually not too long after that Perry came to me with the latest issue of the Skeptical Inquirer and said, take a look at this. Look at the back of that magazine. And if you don't know, the Skeptical Inquirer is a journal published by PsyCop, now CSI, certainly one of the biggest publications in skepticism. And I looked at the back. Okay, what am I looking for? There was a list of local skeptical organizations in the back of the Skeptical Inquirer. There's about 40 or 50 of them. He said, what do you notice? I don't know. He had to always maximize the drama, Perry. I couldn't just come right out and say what he was asking. What are you noticing there? Come on. So I didn't know what he was driving at. He said, is there any organization? Look for Connecticut. There's no skeptical organization in Connecticut. I'm like, okay. Then he said, we have to form the Connecticut Skeptical Society. And I was like, until that moment, it hadn't occurred to me. Who knows if it ever would have occurred to me to do that. But it was immediately a great idea. Right. I mean, as soon as he said it, like, of course we do. Of course we have to do that. And that's how the Connecticut Skeptical Society was born, and which soon thereafter became the New England Skeptical Society. This was in 96, right?
Yep.
96, so it's been 12 years. For a long time, we were just another local skeptical group. We put out a pretty good newsletter. Other than that, you know, we held local meetings. We did what all the other 60 groups did. There really wasn't much of a national movement. There were three national groups, but they were entities unto themselves and didn't really organize local groups underneath them. That all changed 3 years ago. This time it was my turn to come with the dramatic proposal when I went to these guys and said, you know what, we should do a podcast. A friend of ours had introduced us to the notion of podcasts. And right, it was Shane Brown. Hey, we should turn these political discussions that we have all the time into a podcast. Like, what the hell is that podcast? And then once he explained it to me, I'm like, oh, it's a really good idea. No, we should do a skeptical podcast. And then I stole that idea from him and came to these guys and said, you know what, this is what we got to do. And I laid it all out. We got to do a skeptical podcast with this kind of format. It was an obvious good idea. You know, Perry and I had been trying to get like a radio show kind of thing going for years, but it's hard, you know, to find a station that will put this kind of a show on. So we just took sort of the ideas that we had kind of been throwing around if we had ever got the opportunity to do a radio show and turn that into a podcast. So here we are now, 3 years later. We have about 42,000-43,000 weekly listeners, about 100,000 weekly downloads of our show. Our most listened to show is up at 59,000. So pretty successful. I mean, definitely successful beyond our dreams. And Perry always dreamed big. Perry was always, one of my favorite stories about him was when he wants to get into something, there's no limit, you know, to his ambition or his vision. He wanted to create a painting, a work of modern art. And he was going to get Andy Warhol to sign off on this project, who's a big name. And his idea was you hang a canvas over some street in downtown Manhattan, like Broadway, and then you have cars drive underneath it and throw paint up and paint with a paintbrush as they drive underneath it. And that was going to be a massive work of modern art.
A modern art masterpiece.
Like as if they weren't going to throw hamburgers up at it and everything.
Whatever. It was organic art.
Blood.
Fingers, whatever. But that was always the scale of Perry's ambitions and imagination. You know, he typically would run into logistical problems, you know. And then that would kind of trip him up, and then he would go on to the next big idea. He was in love with the big ideas. The logistics and the details, that was for other people to worry about. Which I think is why Perry and I together worked really well, because I basically became the detail person and the logistical person who made things actually happen. But he never let me forget that he gets the credit for having the big original idea. It is literally true that we are all here because of Perry's big idea that he had 12 years ago, that we needed to be involved actively in the skeptical movement. So I'm going to turn over. We're going to have brief talks by Terrence Hines and Steve Mirsky. Then we're going to do science or fiction. And then we're going to do a live Q&A. Terrence Hines will be speaking next. Terrence Hines is a neuroscience professor at Pace University and the author of Pseudoscience and the Paranormal, one of the early real seminal works in critically analyzing the paranormal. Terrence, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I want you to all go out and buy a copy of the book. I really need the 5 cents I get from each copy from those bastards at Prometheus. I couldn't help overhearing some of the discussion that was going on before we all came out here about the level of nonsense in the media. I'm a fan of WQXR, the New York Times flagship classical music station, and they are not immune to nonsense either. They've been broadcasting ads recently for an IQ method that is guaranteed in 7 minutes. 7 minutes! I tell you, to increase the speed of your brain. I'm not quite sure what that means. But I'm going to, there's an 800 number and you call for a free something or other, I'm going to get it. But I'm also going to communicate with their director or whatever the station manager is and point out that this is nonsense. That can be quite effective, and I urge you all to do that sort of thing. Some years ago, there was something called the See Clearly method that was advertised widely on local radio stations, and the claim was that your eyesight is getting bad because your glasses make your eyes get worse. And if you buy this stuff and throw away your glasses, you'll get better. A little Google search turned up the fact that the Iowa Attorney General had indicted these folks, and in part of the indictment documents was the finding that about 50% of the people who worked in the See Clearly method offices wore glasses. Yes, gives me confidence.
Amazing.
And you know, even last night I was watching TV and I saw one of these ads for this head-on stuff, which is completely homeopathic. You know, you have a headache and you rub this stuff on your head and the headache goes away after a day or two. And they've also come out with one that's supposed to make scars go away. It's called Activon. And the rumor is that they're coming out with a homeopathic Viagra. It's going to be called Hard On.
Yeah, that one you have to rub in really good, right?
Yeah, right.
Nice.
Along the same lines, I have a pretty good spam filter, but something got through my spam filter the other day, and it was this a new surgical technique that could give you a 9-inch penis. And I emailed back and immediately said, I don't care how good your surgeons are, you're not cutting 4 inches off of me. And that concludes my humorous remarks. Now to my actual talk. I want to contrast two different science, pseudoscience and a real science, astrology and astronomy. I'm not going to go into the data. It's kind of a historical comparison. And it has to do with the discovery of the planet Neptune. Neptune was not discovered until the mid-1800s. And the story of its discovery really makes clear the difference between the pseudoscience of astrology and the science of astronomy. We have to go back to 1740-something and the discovery of the planet Uranus. One wants to be careful about how one pronounces that name. Uranus is discovered, and it's plotted. Its position is plotted in the sky over the next several decades. And astronomers quite readily notice that Uranus is behaving badly for a planet. It's not following Newton's laws. And a debate breaks out as to why that's the case. One possibility is that Newton's laws were wrong. It turns out that they were, but we'll see that in a different way. The other possibility, is, as some astronomers point out, is maybe there's some other planet out there that's really big, and so it's having a gravitational influence on Uranus that will explain the perturbations from the Newtonian orbit. And so the search was on. And in the 1840s, a couple of mathematicians, John Couch Adams in England and Le Verrier in France, did the calculations, and it's so easy to say that, did the calculations, because when we do those calculations, we have a computer and we just punch in the numbers. This was paper and pencil calculations, and you know, you may learn Newtonian mechanics in introductory astronomy now, and it's kind of simple. It wasn't then. But the interesting thing was, as I said, that both Adams and Le Verrier postulated another planet that had not yet been found. And they did the calculations, and given the information about how Uranus's orbit was out of sync with Newton's orbits, Newton's calculations or Newton's laws, they predicted where a new planet would be. Adams went to the Astronomer Royal and said, look there in the night sky on such and such a night, and you will see a new planet. And the Astronomer Royal said, you're a mathematician, I don't care about you. Le Verrier, the same month, went to an astronomer in France and said, look there in the night sky. The French astronomer did so and discovered Neptune. So here's making a prediction from perturbations and finding a new planet. Let's compare that to astrology. If planets have some astrological influences, astrologers claim that they do, we should have had a scenario where astrologers are at the annual meeting of the Rhine Astrology Association, and when they're all sitting at the bar, and my experience with scientific meetings is that much of the good science gets done at the bar. So they're sitting at the bar, and one guy says, well, you know, I cast a horoscope of Prince Hermann the Ignorant, and the horoscope said he should be a coin collector, and he's not. I don't understand this. It's an anomaly from how our astrology theories work. And the other guy sitting at the bar says, you know, that's funny. I cast the horoscope of Queen Beatrice the Bold, and I found that she was supposed to be a great seamstress, and that wasn't the case. And then people start talking about, well, I found these funny things, too, that astrological theory can't explain. Maybe there's another planet. Y'all think that astrologers ever did anything close to that? Of course not. Of course, after Neptune was discovered, they assigned influences to it. And that great astrologer who wrote Linda Lovelace and Linda Goodman confused. I'm not sure who's being insulted there. Anyway, Linda Goodman in her book Love Signs back in the 60s said that, well, planets don't have any influence until astronomers find them. Yeah. Now, there's another planet whose orbit does not obey Newtonian laws. Anybody know what planet that is? Mercury. Absolutely right. Mercury. So put yourself in the position of a 19th century astronomer who has just seen the great success of explaining Uranus's abnormal orbit by postulating another planet. It was very reasonable to postulate that Mercury's weirdnesses were due to another planet. And that planet was called, anybody know?
Vulcan.
Vulcan, exactly. I'd love to know if Roddenberry knew that when he named Spock's planet. In any event, people saw Vulcan. There are lots of reports in the astronomical literature of people saying, yeah, I saw Vulcan, which shouldn't surprise any of us because lots of people saw the canals on Mars. Le Verrier, who had found Neptune, spent the rest of his life trying to figure out where Vulcan was in the sky, doing the calculations, and you probably see where this is going. Those calculations proved impossible to do. Well, the astrologers weren't going to be left out again. So starting about the late 1800s, early 1900s, they started assigning influences to the planet Vulcan. And in Linda Goodman's book, again, she does the same and says that astronomers any day now, this was back in 1962 or 3, I think, any day or any month now, astronomers are going to discover the planet Vulcan. Oops. So here we have the astrologers jumping on the bandwagon and assigning influences to a planet that in turn, turns out, never existed. Why is Mercury's orbit abnormal? It's abnormal because non-Newtonian. It's non-Newtonian because Mercury is very, very near the massive Sun. And Mercury's orbit is predicted precisely by Einstein's theories, as was demonstrated in 1915. So it's an amusing case study of astrologers being caught out once, never having predicted the existence of a planet. Then when astronomers predict a planet that turns out not to exist, the astrologers jump on the bandwagon and assign influences to it. Oops, it wasn't there in the first place. So I think that shows truly the pseudoscientific nature of astrology compared to astronomy. Thank you.
Next, we have, again, joining us again from last year, and also Steve has actually been coming to New England Skeptical Society local events for years. He and John Rennie have been regulars at our summer picnics that we used to have, so we're always happy to have him back. Steve Mirsky is an editor for Scientific American. He writes the anti-gravity column, and he is the host of Science Talk, which is one of the highest rated science podcasts on iTunes. This morning, I just checked just to see where he was, and Science Talk is ranked number 4, right up there with the big boys, and you know, Nova and...
People who have actual broadcasting equipment.
People who have money and equipment, right. So, Steve, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. We didn't plan this, but I have a horoscope here that I'm going to read to you, and I'm going to skip some of the introduction and just tell you that... We decided to run a horoscope in Scientific American, which obviously had never been done before. And I point out that it's not based on science because it's impossible to have a horoscope based on science, but it's science heavy. And specific predictions accompany individual zodiacal signs as per the form of the typical newspaper or magazine horoscope. And shame on all you allegedly legitimate news outlets for running such garbage. Some of the predictions may seem intimately related to the sign in question. Even so, consider them all totally interchangeable, as the truly important aspect of the coordinates of your birth would be the GDP at that time and place. And here we go. First, any Aquarians in the audience?
I have an aquarium.
He has an aquarium. Please, when somebody asks you that question, don't answer it. Anyway, Aquarius, when you walk through a storm, hold your head up high is a lovely song lyric, but terrible advice if the storm is electrical. Pisces, you fear the addition of fish proteins to ice cream, added to improve smoothness. I know people who are actually afraid of this. But you're basically just a modestly modified fish, anatomically, physiologically, and genetically. So take some omega-3 pills and read Neil Shubin's book, Your Inner Fish, you know, just for the halibut. Sorry. Aries, your attempt to clone your dog Binky based on the hope that Binky, too, will know where original Binky hid the leather wallet he took off your end table and hid for the last time just before he died of distemper betrays your utter ignorance of both cloning and of Binky's deeply malevolent nature. Taurus, while looking at a region of space in which a supernova was in progress, researchers at Princeton University recently noted the beginning of another supernova through the detection of X-rays, which reminds me the films came back and the radiologist says your arm is broken in 2 places. Gemini, the influence of genetics on behavior is apparently so strong that you and the identical twin brother you haven't seen since birth and don't even know about both spend most of your time watching sports on television, whereas the average American man only spends a great deal of his time watching sports on television. Cancer, rather than employing hemoglobin, the blood of the horseshoe crab contains hemocyanin, which binds oxygen with copper rather than iron. The crab's blood is therefore a beautiful pale blue rather than the bright red viscous liquid that will continue to run out of your arm unless you get a tourniquet on it soon. I think, speaking of Vulcan, I think that's Mr. Spock's blood situation as well, isn't it?
Blue, copper-based blood.
Right.
That's a good
detail. Leo.
Spock's a crab.
A fatal Alzheimer's-like disease that attacks cheetahs' internal organs and has impeded breeding of the cats in captivity may be spread by their feces. Thus ran a report on May 12th on the Scientific American website. So remember that when it comes to longevity, waste makes haste. Would you have preferred cheetahs never prosper? Virgo, some people are against the use of a cervical cancer vaccine because they fear it will promote promiscuity. This is roughly the equivalent of being against the use of the polio vaccine because it may increase the risk of drowning in public swimming pools. Libra, the good news is that you will be part of an investigation using the advanced forensic CSI techniques that you find so fascinating. Methodologies like DNA amplification that can identify a person based on only the tiniest amounts of physical remains. That's also the bad news if you see where we're going with this. Scorpio, if you hadn't been born prematurely, you could have been a Sagittarius, maybe even a Capricorn. But it's the related fact that your mother smoked while she was pregnant that's the salient point in influencing your life's trajectory. Sagittarius, you will go on a long journey when you become a highly trained astronaut and travel to the International Space Station to fix the toilet, which apparently broke again this past week. It must just be a horrible place to be, the International Space Station. And finally, Capricorn, your former opposition to embryonic stem cell research becomes grudging support when you realize that Michael J. Fox isn't shaking. You are. And let me just add that I got a letter to the magazine complaining because the reader took it that we were making fun of Michael J. Fox, which, you know, I hope it came across that we were making fun of those people who always are against some particular form of medical research until they realize that it might benefit them when they suddenly come around on it.
Steve, what about our Orpheus listeners? That's what it is, right?
Orpheus?
Orpheus, yeah. I mean,
the 13th.
That's the 13th sign.
Symbological sign.
It's tucked away at the end of the year there. They're going to feel left out.
They always get screwed.
They
the
really
Orpheicans,
do.
Forget about it.
I'm proud to announce I'd never heard of that before.
That's a good point.
You didn't get any letters from Orpheicans complaining that?
Well, by nature, they're very shy and retiring.
They're a silent minority.
Evan, you have your item for the day to tell us about.
Yeah, well, you know, today is October 11th, and I did a little research into this. And lo and behold, what a coincidence for the show today. I found out that today is National Coming Out Day. So thank you all for coming out to the podcast. I appreciate it very much. Some other things happened this day in history. Space-related, 1958, NASA launches lunar probe Pioneer 1. The probe falls back to Earth and burns up. 1968, launches Apollo 7. This is the first successful manned Apollo mission. 1984, Space Shuttle Challenger astronaut Catherine Sullivan becomes the first American woman to perform a spacewalk. And in 2000, it was the 100th mission for the space shuttle.
Well, thank you, Evan. We're going to do a quick science or fiction, and then the rest of the show we'll have dedicated to questions and answers.
It's time for science or fiction.
So I'm going to read the three items. We'll get a quick survey from the audience, see what you guys think. And then we'll just get general comments from the panel and then from you guys. I do ask that if you know for absolutely certain that one item is true or false, don't give that away. Like, don't say, I read that item, or I I'm the guy who published that research.
Just send a text to my like cell phone.
All right, so here they are. Number one, a new study shows that pregnancy does not have a detrimental effect on cognition. Item number two, researchers have designed an artificial living cell that can efficiently generate electricity and potentially be used to power small implantable medical devices. Item number three, a new study shows that women in U.S. schools are making significant gains in mathematics, rapidly closing the gender gap. So first, let's take a quick survey. So number one is pregnancy does not cause problems with cognition. Number two is an artificially living cell that generates electricity for implantable devices. And item number three is that women in U.S. schools are closing the gender gap in mathematics. So how many people in the audience think that number one, the pregnancy and cognition, is the fiction?
Steve, would you elaborate on that a bit?
No.
Whose cognition are you talking about?
The pregnant women.
Okay. Just want to clear
okay.
that.
Bob also doesn't know how babies are made.
That's true.
That'll be a future science or fiction.
So, once again, how many people think that one's the fiction? Number two, researchers have designed an artificial living cell that can efficiently generate electricity and potentially be used to power small implantable medical devices. How many people think that one is the fiction? A little more, I think. Item number three, a new study shows that women in the U.S. schools are making significant gains in mathematics, rapidly closing the gender gap. Okay. So I think it was 2, 1, 3. Does that sound about right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so why don't we start? Okay, we'll start over here with Terrence. So just give us your thoughts on that. And again, don't tell us that you did the research and you know what the answer is.
I did the research on all three of those, of course.
General comments.
The first one, I never was aware that there was any claim that being pregnant had either a positive or a negative effect on cognition. So I guess I would think that if there's a study that shows it doesn't, then I would think that was true. The study was true. Number two is the cell.
Right.
I think that's fiction. And because I've read it, I won't comment on number three.
Okay. Steve?
When I heard number two, I just figured that had to be the fiction, and so I didn't have to bother to think about one and three.
Okay. All right. So you agree with the audience?
Yeah, I agree with the audience.
The most implausible one?
I don't think we're that close to being able to develop any kind of a artificial living cell, and if we did, I don't think that's what we would be worried about using it for.
Evan?
Yeah, cell. Sounds the least plausible, certainly.
Okay.
And I'll also say that I did not know there was any cognition issues one way or the other with pregnant women. Never heard that before, ever.
No, actually, labor itself has some pretty dramatic effects.
Oh, sure.
On
oh, sure, yeah.
That's
yeah, but issue. The man's okay. Don't worry.
That's right.
What do you think, Jay?
Like Bob, I want more information on a couple of these. You said that pregnancy, they found, does not have an effect on cognition.
A detrimental effect on cognition.
Because I would tend to think maybe it would, I'd like to hear a word like long-term effect versus an overall effect or a long-lasting effect. Or you know, I need a timetable on
it. It was during the duration of the study, which was short-term in that it was a few years. It wasn't long-term like 10 or 20 years.
Okay, so women were
during the pregnancy and for a few years following the pregnancy,
okay.
No detrimental effect on cognition.
Okay. The second one about the artificial living cell. So I want more information on what you mean by artificial living cell.
So, and maybe Steve was getting some what you said. It wasn't a cell created completely from the ground up, but it was designed. So it's not a cell that occurs in nature. But it was an artificial cell in that it was designed. They tweaked it. They changed
it. It was manipulated.
It was manipulated.
But weren't all cells designed, Steve?
He's a creationist. Get him.
This one was top-down designed by scientists who manipulated its genetics in order to have these particular properties, to be a little living battery.
So it was converting glucose to electricity.
What's that?
It was converting what in the body to electricity?
Food. What do all cells live off of? Converts food to electricity.
That would be awesome. That'd be like you hold your phone and you're powering your phone. You don't have to, you know, you're the battery. Okay. See, I want that one to be true.
Matrix.
And then women are gaining in mathematics on men over.
They're closing the gap.
They're closing the gap. I would totally believe that. I'm gonna go out on a limb and say I think the pregnancy one is the fake.
Okay, Rebecca.
Apparently I'm the only one who was under the impression that pregnancy did have a change in cognition. Let me lay this out for you. Woman has a baby. It pukes everywhere. It poops. And she loves it. Like, it's basically the most disgusting parasite you can have.
Becky, you're so maternal.
So I... For 18 years.
They do stop puking eventually. It doesn't last all 18 years.
Then they start
years.
Up again.
Until they get to college. Yeah.
Some of us do.
Oh, I see. You're using yourself as the normal. Okay, now I get it.
Where did you get the 18 years? It's more like at least 26. It's through your first postgraduate degree.
Where
are you going with this?
I just always assume there must be some kind of mental retardation associated with pregnancy. So I would be inclined to go for that one. However, I do think that that's probably science. However, I think that the idea of an artificial living cell converting food to energy is a nice thought, but probably fiction. And for the third one, women gaining on men in math goes along with pretty much what we've been seeing in general in terms of science and all that good stuff. So I think that that's science.
Okay, Bob.
All right, I'll just go get a coffee.
Yeah, whatever.
When you said it's top down, the synthetic biology, it's top down. So they're taking existing cells and manipulating them. That I actually think is more feasible than the bottom-up approach, where they're actually making progress in synthetic biology and creating cellular membranes and stuff, and actually they're getting pretty close to creating a real cell. I think it's generally expected within a few years. But
something like a bacteria.
Right, yeah. But bottom-up I think is tougher. Top-down, I think that it does sound somewhat feasible, manipulating the organelles in a cell to do that. That doesn't sound like a crazy breakthrough to me. So I'm going to actually think, I think that's science. The third one, though, closing the gap, I don't think, they might be closing the gap. I don't think there's that much interest, though. I think it's still predominantly men that are going into it. I'm going to say three is science fiction.
Okay, so let's, after that insightful feedback from our panel.
Did you see the study this week about if you have a choice of three things and you pick one, you're better off than changing your choice?
Let's not get into that again.
Monty Only Ball. If you're given that choice.
But let's see, have they influenced you? So let's go again. Who think the pregnancy and cognition one is the fiction? The living cell making electricity. And women in schools closing the gender gap.
Okay. Evened out a bit.
Evened out a little bit.
Bob didn't know that Winnie from the Wonder Years is now a big-time mathematician.
That's true.
I did know that.
Well, it's encouraging the girls.
Well, take these in order. Start with the first one. A new study shows that pregnancy does not have a detrimental effect on cognition. That one is science. And there was a conventional wisdom that women had silly hormones when they were pregnant and they had a hard time concentrating or were forgetful. Yeah, when the hormone, hormonal change, it's plausible. Hormones affect brain function. And the thinking, conventional wisdom was that, the hormonal changes during pregnancy might have had problems with short-term memory, and there was some anecdotal evidence for that. But this was a survey where they had data following women in their 20s over a 5 or 6 year period, and they then looked and say, okay, well, those women who answered this survey and this test on cognition during their pregnancy, did their scores dip, or were they on average lower than people who were not pregnant at the time? And then followed them out for the duration of that survey, and there was no dip and no change afterwards. So no effect was measurable in this survey. Although the survey wasn't designed to do this. This was going back and reanalyzing data that had been collected for more generic reasons. So that this is not the last word or definitive, but at least in this study, there was no evidence of any change in cognition during or after pregnancy in 20-year-olds.
But, Steve, did all the women still love their babies? They're still saying that's a little suspicious.
All right. Number two, researchers have designed an artificial living cell that can efficiently generate electricity and potentially be used to power small implantable medical devices. And that one is science.
Yeah. Wow. Look how pleased he is with that.
Good work, Bob. And I'm actually a little surprised that you guys haven't heard about this. This exists. This is called the Electrocyte. And which exists in what animal, do you think? The electric eel. Electric eels generate lots of electricity, and they generate it out of the food that they eat. That's because they have cells. They're modified nervous tissue type cells. All cells have a potential across their membrane. Heart cells have evolved to exploit that, modify it so that they could, you know, beat in regular rhythm. The nervous system modifies that to conduct electrical signals, and then the electric eel further modifies that to actually build up an electric charge and then discharge it. They actually convert food to electricity. What these guys did, and these were some Yale neuroscientists, what these guys did is they modified the electrocyte from the electric eel to make it 5 times more efficient.
Wow.
And it's a little living battery that can survive off of food, off of, you know, if you give it blood flow, blood supply, it'll make energy, it'll make electricity. And the hope is that these things could be used to indefinitely power implantable medical devices. And that's actually if not the hugest limiting factor for implantable medical devices. We can make devices that could pump out insulin, that could, you know, do other drug deliveries, that can function as, you know, filtering the blood for artificial kidneys, do all kinds of great things, or be an artificial heart or whatever. The biggest limiting factor is that where do you put the battery? You know, where do you put the energy source? You know, battery technology, although getting better, the batteries still have to be rather huge and bulky, and, you know, there's not really any convenient place to put them, and you can't put them inside the body, so you end up wearing them on the outside. This would be a game changer.
Yeah, right.
This would definitely be a game changer in terms of implantable medical devices. This would be awesome. So a 5 times improvement in efficiency is a big deal.
This is also a huge leap forward in terms of creating new supervillains.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Electro-Man.
I was thinking of when the evil emperor hits Darth Vader with the...
Oh, yeah. That's highly plausible. I mean, you know, having electrocytes in your hand... You could give people a zot just like an electric eel. There's nothing implausible about that. I mean, animals have evolved to do that by themselves. I mean, that's actually not as hard as you might think. You just inserting genes for electrocytes in your skin.
And Steve, that was said with all the enthusiasm of someone who clearly spends a lot of time thinking about how plausible
I've thought about that
Star
before.
Wars situations could be.
This is not the first time I've thought about the electrocytes in the palm of the hand. Yes.
If I had an Ewok, there is a chance.
Do you have to be completely immersed in salt water for it to really work? Because that could limit your ability to...
Yeah, that's true. Well, you have to have glands that secrete it, I guess, on the skin as well. Which means that a new study shows that women in U.S. schools are making significant gains in mathematics, rapidly closing the gender gap, is the fiction.
That's depressing. Oh.
And Terrence, you read that study?
Well, I thought I'd read a study that showed that was true.
No, it's actually getting worse. The study shows that we're going in the wrong direction, that women, that U.S. medical, U.S. students, especially women, are getting worse in mathematics, and women are getting more worse than men.
I blame Winnie from the Wonder Years.
most of the positions in graduate school, whatever, are being filled by foreign students because we are not producing enough students in mathematics and the sciences and engineering to fill our graduate and postgraduate posts. And they do blame it on cultural influences. They say that other Western countries, especially for whatever reason, Eastern European countries and Asian countries, I think just because of cultural reasons, actually cultivate mathematical and scientific talent. This was focusing on mathematical talent. These students get identified and nurtured early on, and it's prized as, you know, this is a valuable thing. We need to cultivate those students who have talent. What the study showed is that women at younger ages have as much mathematical talent as boys do. There are some very talented, you know, women in terms of their mathematical ability, their talent, but they just don't develop it. They don't go on to careers in mathematics because they're discouraged. Not that they're not encouraged. Women are actually actively discouraged from pursuing mathematics because of the feedback that they get in the culture. That's what the study showed. So,
Steve, I read that study too, and like Terrence, I thought that I skimmed that study. But
just why you got it wrong, right?
Yes. But I thought that the point of that was more to the point of, like you said, about us competing with
right.
foreigners and how men and women in the U.S. are kind of pushed down and discouraged
right.
from pursuing math.
But it made the point that it was worse for women.
I feel like there have been a lot of other studies, though, that have shown the opposite to be true, that women are making gains on men, and that the problem comes when you get to keeping them in academia past graduation. That's when things have not gotten any better because we haven't solve like basic problems of, you know, providing adequate health care. Right. And
they are making gains in science in general, but they're not making gains in engineering and mathematics. Those are the areas where they're not keeping pace with the improvements that they're seeing in scientific fields in general. And then if you look within science, you could even break it down further. In the health sciences, huge gains. Other ones that are traditionally you would think of as more male, they're making gains, but not as much. And then when you get to the hardcore, really culturally male-dominated things like engineering and mathematics, they haven't been seeing the gains. So
we all did pretty bad.
Except Bob. Bob got it right.
Yeah.
So thanks for playing along with us, everybody. It was a lot of fun. So this, we are now going to move into the Q&A section of the podcast. I hope you guys brought a lot of questions for us.
All right, so with the economy tanking and stuff, like the end of the world seems to be like popping up like all the time. Is there actually any like real plausible end of the world or, you know, like major disruption in our, you know, what we think of our great lives or whatnot? Is there any like real plausible scenarios like in the next 10, 20?
Absolutely. You stick around for a few more billion years and you'll see the end of the world.
I happen to be reading right now, and I'm saying this purely to make you all jealous. I'm reading Phil Plait's book about the end of the world. It's going to be coming out in 10 days, I think. And it's fantastic. It's called Death from the Skies. Really cheery, and it details dozens of ways that we can die a horrible, fiery death at the hands of the cosmos.
You probably meant sooner than that, though, right? There's no, you know, all the end of the world doomsday things. You know, of course, there's always some group somewhere, somebody claiming that the end of the world is around the corner for various reasons, and it's obviously never come true so far.
And one person's end of the world is not the same as another person's end of the world. I mean, for somebody, really, I mean, it could be just losing all power, electrical shutdown. To them, that would be the end of the world.
But you also talk about civilization collapse, not necessarily, you know, the earth opening up and everyone falling in, but just economic collapse, things like that. I mean, you know, that's going to happen to some degree. It's, I think, a matter of severity, not whether or not we're going to see periods of turbulence.
I've always wanted to meet one of these people who really claimed and presumably really believed that, you know, the rapture was going to come about in 18 months and put in front of them a contract that says in 19 months I will own every piece of their personal property. Because if the rapture's really coming, who cares?
Yeah. They lack commitment.
Didn't the church do that in the year 1000 or in the 900s, they said, you know, everyone was afraid of the millennia coming, and the church kind of just sucked up everybody's everything.
I don't know.
And then I remember reading that. I can't cite it, but it's
a good
in
that's
my
a hell of a scam. That's good.
Let's get in on this.
Well, that's the basic scam of end of the world cults, doomsday cults, is that, you know, you don't need all of your personal belongings, your worldly goods. So give them to us,
Rolex.
And then we'll make sure that you survive. You know, whatever is to come. You'll get you on the UFO, or you'll get raptured, or whatever the gig is.
And let's use this moment to remind everyone that when the LHC gets ramped up, hopefully next year, not the end of the world. Not the end of the world.
My question relates to what we were just talking about, the mathematics and women. My daughter has a degree in mathematics from NYU. And when she was signing up for classes her freshman year, she had to struggle to sign up for calculus, because they kept saying, "Oh, you don't have to take calculus; you can take Caribbean dance." And she actually, if she wasn't a strong-willed person as she is, she might, you know, might have been convinced to go to the non-mathematics. So, what are recommendations we can put out there to try to counter that the way it's going of not increasing women in mathematics and science?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because it sounds like the primary problem is culture, and that's a hard thing to move. You know, you could try to influence the culture. You know, we obviously try to do it in our small way. But how do you influence, how do you change the culture? You know, that's a tough one.
Raise strong daughters.
Yeah. Right.
Sounds like you had a good start.
Well, actually, there is evidence that the strongest predictor of a girl going into one of these disciplines, science or mathematics, is a supportive male figure in the family, a supportive father.
But also, I think we really have to make an effort to change the anti-intellectual culture that we're in general, so that men and women, boys and girls, are all comfortable comfortable pursuing careers in math and science because, yes, it's worse for women because they've got the sexist part of the culture going against them too. But we've got to really get on the ball as we did in the late 50s, early 60s, and tell everybody, you got to get off your butts. You're not all going to be video producers, and you're not all going to play Major League Baseball. You better learn some math and science so that we can compete internationally, or else a generation from now, you're going to be working in fancy hotels in Europe changing the sheets.
That's a really good point. And when you think about it from that standpoint, consider that when you encourage men to appreciate an intellectual environment, you're also encouraging them to encourage women to be intellectuals as well. And so I think you're right. I think it's all together.
I think we need to break into mainstream media. Promoting science is something that's cool and that's empowering, I think, is what has to be done. But, you know, we're laboring away. We have some outlets like Scientific American who gets it and who's trying to promote science culturally, not just, you know, teach science to the people who are already scientific. But in the mainstream media, it's really just starting to leak in there. We've got Mythbusters now. There's a few shows starting this season, The Mentalist and 11th Hour, which we, you know, stole from the UK.
Which is awesome.
Psyched. You know, so there are some shows that are, you know, actually have a scientist in a positive role.
Unashamed, on topic. There was a show, Numbers, that was about mathematicians. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that still on the air?
It was on last night, wasn't it?
But it's still, generally speaking, if you like science and math, you're a nerd. And if you, you know, like sports and whatever, then you're cool. And that has to fundamentally change to some degree, at least to the point where you're not actively discouraging people who are talented and should be going into it.
Yeah, but the cool factor with nerds has gone up dramatically in the past 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, look at the Big Bang Theory. I mean, it's still stereotyping nerds, although they kind of get a lot of it right. But in a way, it's kind of nerd cool. So there's a little nerd cool going on, which didn't really exist 10, 15 years ago. But it's not enough. We need to keep doing more. We need to mainstream this as much as possible. I don't know what else to do, really.
My question also has to do with the economy. I've been reading up as much about the economy as I do about science and skepticism. And there is a lot of conspiracy theories out there, people who think that the Federal Reserve controls the world, people who think that the economy is deliberately being brought down for some nefarious purpose. On the other side, though, on Wall Street, we have a bunch of people who seem to have bought into a giant Ponzi scheme. And my question is, can the principles of critical thinking and skepticism be applied to economics as well as they can to science?
Well, one of the members of the New England Skeptical Society is John Blumenfeld, who was blogging for us on Rose Gallery up until a few weeks ago and actually started his own blog called The Long Run, which is about skepticism and economics. Unfortunately, the company that he works for told him he can't do that anymore. Because when you are an investment manager, your reputation is what is your value. And they don't want to have him have any public footprint that they are not maniacally in control of. Because they want to manage his public perception. They don't want one of their potential clients Googling his name and seeing that he's writing some blog and saying who knows what. That's not going through their PR department. That may change over time. Right now they're just paranoid. So our attempts to break into economic skepticism have been shut down, essentially, by the financial company that John Blumenfeld works for. But absolutely, critical thinking and skepticism applies to economics and economic theory. There's a lot of conspiracy thinking, pattern recognition, pseudoscience, you know, basically astrology-type stuff of the stock market going on. It's a chaotic system that nobody really understands and certainly nobody controls. And there is evidence that a feeling of lack of control actually increases people's conspiratorial and superstitious thinking. So it would make sense that in the chaotic, uncontrollable environment of the economics that people are going to appeal and reach for these superstitious instincts and pattern recognition instincts that we have. The cure for that, the treatment for superstition, is critical thinking and understanding science and unbiased and blinded kind of assessments, things like that.
Speaking of good books to read, if you're interested in the scientific take on things like economics, is I just read Dan Ariely, I think that's how you pronounce his name, who just won an Ig Nobel Prize the other last week. He wrote a book called Predictable Irrationality, and it's all about his oftentimes very bizarre and interesting research into why we make seemingly irrational decisions as a group, as individuals, and he's done, you know, real tests to determine exactly how we're making those crazy decisions that lend themselves to economics. So I'd recommend that.
And there's a nice column that I read on the train coming here in today's Times on the first page of the Metro section about irrationality in the market and how in hindsight it looks inevitable, but we keep falling for these booms and the inevitable crash, you know, on a cyclical basis.
My question kind of extends the same theme to the world of politics. So we're in the political season. And it seems like, to me, politics has become more like religion, right? In other words, there seems to be more bias than ever, and the notion of investigative journalism seems kind of oxymoronic. It seems like everyone you listen to has already made up their mind before they tell you the facts. What happened to investigative journalism?
Well, I've been blogging about that a lot recently. I don't think this is a new thing. I think maybe that's always the perception, but what you're describing is the default mode of human behavior. You take a position and then you defend it. You rationalize it. Very few people actually go through a process to decide what to believe. They sort of just believe what their gut tells them to believe, and then they rationalize that away. With politics, it's just set up to be that way. You identify with a political party, with an ideology, and then that's your belief, that's your territory. You defend your turf, and you twist and distort information to fit that ideology, which is exactly what a lot of religions do as well. So politics and religion, you know, there's a reason why that's the cliche. You should never talk about politics and religion, because they share that sort of that mode of defending an ideology. When people are in that mode, you know, then that's a setup for just having a very unproductive argument where you're just going to be, again, trading shots, but not actually doing what would be productive, which is searching for common ground, analyzing your own arguments for their factual basis, their premises, and their logic, which is, so that's the mode of discourse that we're trying to advocate. That's the one that is natural to the scientific process. Absolutely, I think it would, you know, that should be injected more into the political realm. I've, you know, been an advocate for what I would call evidence-based government. You know, imagine if what the government did actually was held to some kind of standard of evidence rather than just always being able to twist the claims that they're making. In terms of journalism, you know, journalism, there's always been a spectrum of quality. There's been focuses, you know, focal points of excellence where you could find a good reporter or an excellent reporter who does his work, who produces excellent columns, who understands the topics at hand. Then a lot of mediocrity, and then some really crappy stuff at the low end, right? That's pretty much most professions or human endeavors.
98% of everything is crap.
Yeah, or at least mediocre.
Mediocre.
Yeah.
But we do have a culture right now within journalism that does not promote the kind of investigative journalism that you're talking about, because we have media conglomeration, for one thing, and a lot of the impulse toward investigation has been traded in for access. And you also have gigantic, very powerful television outlets that have much more power, much more influence than other places. And a lot of the people who are hired there are hired because, you know, they're attractive. And it doesn't have anything to do with their abilities to do real journalism. I mean, I'm lucky. I'm a science journalist, so I don't really have to do much investigative journalism other than read journal articles. But the kind of investigative journalism that you're talking about, where you really get in there and find things out that are buried, the media conglomerates don't really want to do that, a lot of them, because they're owned by the companies that are burying the stuff. And then they don't have the resources. A lot of the places that would like to do it don't have the resources because they're constantly cutting back on personnel.
Steve, would you say that over the past 15 years or so, there's been a change to the idea behind speed to market? Like, it's you know, I always think of Jerry Springer as kind of like the tipping point when things really got irrational. And, you know, people aren't putting the time in to build the news and find out what the real information is. It's like it has to go
well,
like
that's,
this.
That's also a contributing factor. There's no question. I mean, there used to be a news cycle that was a daily news cycle, but now it's a millisecond news cycle. And stuff just gets put on the air that has obviously not... Look, anytime... If you want to listen to the proof of this, just tune into the Howard Stern Show on Sirius and listen to the clips they play of people fooling mainstream journalists and getting on the air with their eyewitness accounts of something. And I'm not talking about necessarily mainstream journalists in a local market either. I'm talking about people like Brian Williams at NBC who gets fooled by somebody saying that they have, that they're an AP reporter and they have discovered that the reason that Princess Di's car crashed was because they were speeding to the video store to rent the Howard Stern movie Private Parts. And this gets on the, and Williams doesn't even hang up yet. Yeah. He asks them for some more information about that. And it's like, you know, come on, let's try to think on our feet a little bit and realize you've been had. You know, they play clips of Peter Jennings getting had. You know, it's just amazing what kind of vetting process goes on in the newsroom, and these people are put on the air. Well, you know, sometimes these people are put on the air and they're faking, but sometimes they're put on the air and they really are there, but who knows what their qualifications are to comment on whatever's going on.
It's kind of like throwing up a bunch of stuff against the wall. Whatever, you know, 100 things won't stick, but if one thing sticks, the media will point to that and say, ha, we were first on that, we got it, we have integrity and we know what we're doing. I guess the public kind of forgets about the 99 other things that fell to the floor in the meantime.
And you also have audience members who, if it comes out of that box, they believe it. So there's currency in saying anything on television.
And on the subject of lazy journalism, I was just listening on the ride down here, actually, to the Little Adams podcast, which is a really great British series. And they just had Ben Goldacre on of Bad Science. And he's fabulous. We love Ben. And
he's a cool cat, man.
He is a cool cat. he was talking about how he was thinking of a way that we can have something that analyzes the day's news and then compares it with every press release that has gone out in the previous few days. Because what you'll find is that the newscasters are just reading these press releases or just reprinting press releases literally word for word. I mean, it's copy-paste from a press release. And it's lazy journalism, and I think a lot of it has to do with the speed required to get something to print as soon as possible.
So the journalism has traditionally had a lot of problems. It's getting worse because it's in the middle of a transition. Maybe we could, at the other end, we'll be in a better place, but I don't think anybody knows yet.
So, like a lot of your listeners and even some of the panel, I don't come from a scientific background. I actually have experience in the liberal arts academia.
Woo.
And yeah. And my question is, I was getting an MA in film studies, and basically I felt like the vast majority of the time everything everybody was telling me there was utter and complete tosh. It was nonsense. And I didn't really have good arguments against it. So what I was curious about is, as I'm sure probably a good number of your listeners might run into it as well, you know, you get into this area where everybody is just quoting Lacan and Freud and all this stuff that really a lot of it isn't scientifically accurate, a lot of it is kind of useless. They start placing expectations on readers or watchers of films or on whatever that really aren't how the brain or how people perceive things. So my question is, aside from Alan Sokol, what is there to help people who are really interested in finding out the truth about that kind of stuff where there is truth? Because I understand a lot of it is very subjective. But where could you go to find out, all right, this doesn't actually happen for that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've thought about that a fair amount. I think one of the characteristics we all talk about of a pseudoscience is the notion of an unfalsifiable hypothesis. That's one against which there can be no conceivable evidence. An example is that I, Terrence Michael Hines, am God incarnate, and I created the universe 30 seconds ago. There's no way you can prove me wrong. But you can send a check to the T. Hines' God Fund, Box 629, Chapel Road, New York. Now, you know, when I do this in my classes, some students will often say, well, wait a minute, Hines, I've got memories from last night, so screw you. And my answer is, well, I'm God. It's a trivial matter for me to twiddle with your neurons and create memories. And then somebody will say, well, perform a miracle. And I'll say, well, I choose not to. Your job is to prove me wrong, not my job to prove you right. Applying that to literature, one of my favorite examples is I grew up in northern New Hampshire, and I love that Robert Frost poem, Stopping by Woods, which many of you know. And in high school and college, that was interpreted as Frost having a death wish because snow was cold, and he says, I have miles to go before I sleep. And this was treated as kind of the gospel by the English
literature. I always thought that was about Santa Claus.
Oh, my God, another interpretation. But my point is that, you know, that's a non-falsifiable hypothesis, this, because this was supposed to be an unconscious death wish. And in this interpretation came about first when Frost was alive, and he said, no, this is bullshit. I didn't mean it at all. I was talking about a lovely event when I was a young man. And the Freudians say, well, that does not mean it's not unconscious. It doesn't disprove our hypothesis. For this was just an unconscious death wish. So even the guy who wrote the poem isn't considered an adequate commentator on why he wrote the poem. So if you look for that kind of unfalsifiability, that's a pretty good guide to nonsense in the literature field. I mean, and then I challenge my students to come up, you know, if you're faced with that in a class, come up with the most bizarre thing you can imagine. I got through my English class at Duke my first semester as an undergraduate that way. We had a paper, a short essay due every Tuesday, I guess, and it had to be about what we were writing about, reading in class. And I just couldn't think of something to write once, and I had been writing some stuff that wasn't symbolic interpretation at all, and the professor really liked that symbolic stuff. So I was stuck, and I just figured I'm desperate. I got to write something. It's Monday night, of course. So I write up this thing about how we were reading English romantic poetry, and I wrote how this is really symbolic of Druid creation mythology. Well, I didn't even know whether Druids had a creation myth at the time. So I just made it up. And I got the paper. I just handed it in, figuring, oh, he's going to give me a D, but at least I'll have handed something in. Paper comes back, and I get a B+, and a little note saying, Mr. Hines, you're finally understanding the symbolic nature of literature. Okay. So for the rest of the semester, everything was Druid creation mythology. And I just prayed that I didn't pray, but you know, I hoped a lot that he wouldn't, that the instructor wouldn't go and look up Druid creation mythology, and he didn't.
This was elves before all the way down.
Yeah, exactly. This was before you could go to www.druidcreationmyth.com and find out. But yeah, so that kind of bullshitty stuff is a good sign to what's not true.
Can I just say, I had a modern myths class in college, and the professor, each week we would either read a book or watch a movie, and I think the very first movie we watched and analyzed for mythological properties was Dirty Harry. And Dirty Harry, apparently, Jesus. Yeah. It's true. He made a very convincing argument. There's, It's classic, like, it was basically like an ink blot. Like, what do you see in Dirty Harry? I see Jesus.
Well, the Red Badge of Courage. In high school, we read the Red Badge of Courage in ninth grade, and the lead character is supposed to be Jesus, too. This
nice.
Jesus guy gets around.
I think Harry Potter is supposed to be Jesus, too.
Yeah, Jesus sells books and movies.
I think one way to also answer the question is, you're never going to know all the information that's out there. We're not all like Steve, where we remember almost everything we read and understand it. And you know, I suffer from a bad memory.
So I've convinced you of that, have I?
Yes. Yeah. The thing is, it's just you know, you're sitting in class as an example, and you're hearing something, and you just think, wow, that sounds like BS to me. You know, you need to put it through your skeptical filters, and this is the thing that we all should constantly be working on: is understanding logical fallacies, understanding the concepts of science, understanding the you know, how we obtain knowledge and truth. And if you put it through that...
And how we deceive ourselves.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and just understanding that we can't even trust our own memories and things like that. Like, building up that body of knowledge in your head is, I think, going to be a tool that you will be able to apply to anything. And then at least you can go back and do some research. You know, you're never going to be like this with everything. But if you can come to some answers that go against at least logic, then you have a basis to start to go back and maybe, you know, deconstruct those things that the people are, the claims that they're making or whatever. And another thing that I do is I'm not afraid anymore to say, I don't know the answer to that now, but I will find, you know, I'll find out. And then
I'll get back to
you,
Charlie.
Yeah, I'll get back to you.
I like
I see Russia.
I like to ask the question constantly, how do I know that and why do I think that? And I'll give you an example of where I posed that to somebody else. I was talking to somebody just a couple of days ago who told me that he really thought that if Obama won, the next day after taking office, he would announce that he's turning America into a Muslim nation. And I said to this person, I said, Dad. I said, what is the mechanism to do that? Even if I stipulate to you that, okay, that is what he wants to do. Let's say that that's true. How do you do that? If the president gets on TV tomorrow and says we're all going to be one thing, how does it work? Regardless of which thing it is, you know, we're all going to be Druid creationists. How do you do it? You really think that everybody, oh, well, I guess I'm going to have to go to mosque tomorrow if I'm not already Muslim. It doesn't work. There's no way to, I mean, forget about the constitutional violations of it. How do you get 300 million people to just say, okay, he said it, it was on TV, he said it, we have to do it, what are you going to do? And, you know, he didn't have an answer for that because he hadn't thought to that next step of how do you make that thing happen? What is the, ask yourself this all the time, what's the mechanism for that?
Just one last comment on that question, because I think, you know, mentioning Sokol, et cetera, brings up, of course, postmodernism, which we could spend 2 hours just talking about postmodernism. I think within the humanities and literature, there's certainly a lot of legitimacy to it in terms of how it, you know, tries to look at things in their cultural context and deconstruct them and whatever. I think the big problem with that is applying it to science. Then you apply this notion that there is no real objective knowledge to a system which is all about finding objective knowledge. That's where the disconnect happens. I think you really just have to understand the nature of postmodernism and why it doesn't apply to any factual claims about reality. If you want to use this as a way of, you know, comparative literature, be my guest. But if you want to say that science is just a cultural narrative imposed upon the weak by the people in control and power, you know, that's a fact.
Steve, don't give it away.
I see. I'm mentioning that because now they won't think that I would lie about it.
I've always wondered how postmodernists get to their conferences, because first of all, you know, all texts are supposed to be deconstructible to mean whatever you want them to mean. So, you know, how do you follow the train schedules? And I mean, I would never get on an airplane that was being maintained by crews who think that the manual means whatever they want it to mean.
It's called Delta Airlines.
Ultimately, I just want to mention that I really find looking for interpretations and things to be really fun and interesting. And even though, you know, I'm like mega skeptic and everything, there's nothing, you know, if you want to read a poem and listen to other people's whacked out ideas of what it means, I think that's a lot of fun because it gets me thinking in a different way. And mm-hmm. I think that's really important. And it's really important when it comes to science as well. A lot of our greatest scientists were creative thinkers. They were able to step away from something and look at it from an angle that nobody else saw. And that's really important. And so, you know, it's important, I think, to not dismiss liberal arts and not to dismiss, you know, people, creative thinking in general, even though, you know, you want to make sure it doesn't get beyond its bounds. But ultimately, it's a cool thing. And I'd say embrace it and use it as a way to make your mind more flexible and also to hone your arguments.
Yeah, I agree. I took a course in undergraduate school on interpreting the films of Stanley Kubrick. It's one of my favorite courses ever.
I know, we hear about it all the
time. I know. Well, it obviously had an influence. But that was as interpretive and, you know, liberal artsy as you can possibly get. But I thought it was fantastic. I went into that course thinking this is all bullshit and came out of it going, oh, this guy actually knows what he's talking about. There is something to this. I mean, there is. But that was not postmodernist deconstructionism. That was, what was Kubrick reading? What did he believe? You know, and how did he use the medium of film in order to have that effect on the audience? So it was actually, I consider, a much more legitimate sort of approach to that kind of thing than postmodernism.
What's your favorite pseudoscience that makes your brain seize whenever you hear anybody say it, and why?
Well, it's kind of passé now, but I cut my skeptical teeth on biorhythm theory. And probably most of you guys are too young to remember that. But this was the idea that at the moment of birth, three cycles, one a 23, one a 28, and one a 33-day cycle start, and they cycle throughout your life, no matter what happens to you. you know, you get exposed to nuclear radiation, you get hit by a cement truck, doesn't matter. So that's the one that really still does. I don't hear much about it anymore. It has died. I mean, there's still biorhythm sites on the net,
you
of course.
Killed it.
Yeah, I kind of did. I wrote a long review paper and kind of killed it.
You
so.
Killed it in the face. Good job.
I can't get enough of creationism and intelligent design. I revel in it. I find it all delicious. I love reading about their craziness and the antics that they're perpetrating. They're incredibly dangerous. And part of why I try to keep up on what they're doing is so that we can keep them from doing it. But I just find it immensely entertaining.
My background is television production. And what I see so much going on lately really does fascinate me in how people misinterpret things that they see on, say, surveillance cameras as ghostly phenomenon or these other crazy things that are perhaps happening. And boy, I look at that and I'm like, nope, that's a bug. Nope, that's some wisp of cloud
also
coming
a bug.
By. Yeah. No, that's also a bug. Yeah. Like,
or a spider. It could be a bug or a spider. Something.
I mean, to the point where I think that really people have to suspend their reality to come on, you know, to come up with some of the answers that they do as to what these things they're seeing in this videotape footage is. And I really find it fascinating and a really an interesting study of how humans process things and how powerful the visual image is and really can suppress a lot of the other critical thinking skills that a person should have.
Maybe it's a Steve thing, I don't know, but creationism has always been my favorite. That was my gateway drug into skepticism, was creationism. You know, to me, even in high school, I was in love with evolutionary theory and paleontology, just thinking about what the world looked like millions of years ago was endlessly fascinating to me. And the notion that somebody could have any familiarity with that body of evidence and deny evolution still is unimaginable to me. It still endlessly fascinates me in this, again, this sort of morbid, pathological way. Plus, as I've said, I think, on the podcast before, creationists are an encyclopedia of logical fallacies. I mean, you could learn. They create new logical fallacies when they run through the existing ones. They really, they find new ways to distort logic and science. It's amazing. You could learn the front and back of skepticism by just studying creationism, really. So it's endlessly fascinating to me as a skeptic.
My reality is completely peppered with, like, the Connie pads and the Noni juice and all of that stuff. Like, I'm fascinated by it because I've had a lot of personal experiences with it, people that I know. I'd like to throw the secret in there as well, like that kind of, like, complete abandonment from any kind of rational thinking or skepticism. I had I build websites or I'm a consultant, software consultant for years, and I at one point in my life I was just taking on clients and building websites, and these people came in, they were selling Noni juice and they wanted a website. I had to let them in. I let them in, and we sat down in my conference room, and I'm like, okay, so what's up? And I was just like, yeah, let me hear it. And they brought out, like, the photocopied list that had been photocopied a million times, and it's the list of all the cures. And I'm loving it. And I'm like, can I keep these materials? You know, you know, and it cured cancer. It could stop you from smoking. It, you know, can help pregnancy. You know, I mean, everything was on there. And then the lady goes, yeah, and I take it, and I have arthritis, and I rub it on my shoulder. And that was a turning point for me. I know it's trivial, but I just couldn't get the idea out of my head, and it's still absolutely ridiculous to me to think that this woman rubs fruit juice on her shoulder and then puts her clothes on and has that situation going on. So that one, that just drives, like, that type of stupid stuff. You know, you put the pads on your feet and you wake up and there's toxins and all that. Like, the fact that people can believe that. But the big one, the big gun for me, and it represents a lot, but Scientology, far and away, is the big fantasy. It's the big fake out. It's the big deceiver on so many levels to me and so many things. And you can hear Tom Cruise do his interview, and he's talking, and then he just throws in the word, you know, Crimenon in there in the middle of his thing. Like, it's literally insanity. It's forced insanity, or it's insanity that you bring in and accept into your life. That, my friends, is the most effed up thing out there on the planet.
That is pretty effed up. I'm going to have to pick TV psychics. TV psychics send me into fits of rage that make me want to stab something. I think Sylvia Brown is the lowest of the low. I think, you know, your kid is dead. Yeah. Like, how did she make it this far? I just want to... Oh,
Rebecca, you didn't get that right. It's the kid's dead.
The kid's dead. Yeah, no, she's awful. I went to a Sylvia Brown show once. It was awful. Like, to see literally hundreds of people filling a convention hall, watching her, it was, and it, what she was doing on stage was just so lame. And she would take questions from the audience. And, you know, these are people who honestly believe that this woman speaks to the spirit world and knows all. And what do they ask her? How many angels are around me? Two, Leroy and Larry. Like, seriously? It's and the fact that, you know, it's mostly women there, and, you know, filling up, back when Montel was on, his entire studio audience was women. And, you know, to see her just with one swipe, like, we joke about your kid's dead, but it's not a joke. She, like, one swipe, she just ruins people's memories of their loved ones. I think it's awful and it's cruel, and yeah, it makes me stabby. So, TV psychics.
For me, one of the biggies is science denial in any form is fascinating. Therefore, ID creationism, I equate it with gravity denial. Like, people that just deny gravity. It's, to me, it's kind of on that level. But the big one for me is any pseudoscience at all that kind of uses quantum mechanics to justify their wackiness. They're, yeah, they're using the counterintuitive aspect of quantum mechanics to say, well, look at nature, how counterintuitive and wacky it is. I'll just take that idea and apply it to my brand of wackiness. And I just love that. I just eat that stuff up.
Well, that is our show. Thank you all for coming. But Jay has some quotes for us to close out the show.
But you should, you have to ask me.
Jay, do you have a quote for us to close out our live show?
I have several tonight.
You have several?
Yes, I have several. I have a few Perry DeAngelis quotes here. These are probably the top five from all the ones that I could find. And this first one is about, he's talking to Rebecca about her being a vegetarian, and he says, "The amount of years that she will live longer than us because of her diet is directly proportional to the horror of her life."
Beautiful quote.
It's true.
Perry also said, "Astrology is as vacuous as the space it worships." And he said, "And remember, chi spelled backwards is crap." This one's pretty famous. "How can two mathematicians come to two different conclusions? Well, one of them's a dick." And the lilt in his voice when he said dick.
Well, one of them's a dick.
Yeah.
One of them's a dick.
And this is my all-time favorite Perry quote. "Yes, I believe that China will control the weather. If it doesn't cooperate, it'll have its shot."
Which it did.
Which it did.
Which it freaking did.
Yeah.
They really did.
In closing out, that was all Perry DeAngelis, a visionary, a skeptic, and a friend of some note.
So thank you all for coming. This concludes our first annual Perry DeAngelis Memorial Live event. Hopefully this will be an ongoing, indefinite thing. But seriously, thanks for coming, and thank you all for joining me. Thank you, Terrence. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you,
Steve. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. And until next week and next year, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.